Support for Small Joys comes from the Columbus Foundation, celebrating the creativity that inspires and strengthens the Central Ohio community every day. More at columbusfoundation.org. Support also comes from the Greater Columbus Arts Council's Columbus Makes Art.
WOSU Public Media, this is Small Joys. I'm Hanif Abdurraqib, and today my guest is Jason Rawls, better known as Jay Rawls. Jay Rawls is a music producer and DJ born and raised in Columbus, Ohio, who has worked with an impressive roster of hip-hop artists, including Talib Kweli and Mos Def in their work as Black Star. He's also turned his passion for hip-hop culture into a career in academia. He earned an educational doctorate from Ohio University and now teaches courses like The Art and Politics of Hip-Hop at Ohio State. Also, a great connection for me personally is that I met Jay Rawls for the first time when I was a really young kid. My oldest brother, who's about 10 years older than me, went to the University of Cincinnati, where he was in the Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity, which is a fraternity that Jay Rawls is also a member of. And so they lived in the same house. And so when I was 10, 11 years old, and I would go up to UC to visit my brother, I would spend time in the kind of world that Jay Rawls was in. And at the time he was, you know, he was like producing for some big names in hip hop, and he had these like great connections working in hip hop. And so I got to watch, you know, kind of from the sidelines. He was the first big musician that I'd ever known. And so there's a real great full circle moment now as we are both grown adults pursuing our art still. So needless to say, I'm a big fan of the music, but I actually I'm interested in this shift of hip-hop entering the classroom in these college settings. Jay Rawls has done it, Ninth Wonder has done it, producers are teaching these courses, and so I was interested in that. So we talk a bit about his bringing hip-hop into the classroom.
When I started teaching in 2002, and I just happened to notice that when I was teaching students, things were different. I was relating to them culturally more so than the other teachers. And I noticed it created a bond. It created a connection, a deep connection. And I started to really hone in on that. And as I started working, I eventually got my master's in education. And then in 2011, I started working on my doctorate in education because I thought that there was a way to combine my two passions of hip hop and education. And so when I finally graduated with my doctorate in education in 2017, I made it my mission to combine hip hop and education. And so what I've been doing, it's funny you mentioned that. I just finished teaching my class here on the campus of Ohio State University, The Art and Politics of Hip Hop. And after that, after I leave here, I'm headed to teach my second class, which is from bebop to doo-wop to hip hop. And I say all of that to say that things are opening up. People are starting to understand the importance of the culture of hip hop within higher education. And that's the exciting part for me. You know what I mean? Like being able to help push the envelope and let people see that hip hop culture is here to stay and that we got something to say.
What do you bring into particularly the history of hip hop class? Like, I mean, are you, by that I mean that in a very literal sense, or what are, you don't have to give me your syllabus, obviously. But,
yeah, here's my syllabus. You can.
Yeah, like, but what are the goals? Because this is an undergrad class, right?
Yes, definitely.
So in acknowledging the generational potential for a generational divide, what do you go into that thinking your goals are going to be?
Basically to give them the culture. So what I do is I go into it with the idea that I'm going to show them how hip hop began, and I really enforce the four main elements. So I talk about them, b-boying, DJing, MCing, and graph. And I really jump into the culture, and I actually have people that are purveyors of the culture of graph writers, DJs, MCs. I actually have them come in and actually spend time with my class. And so the students, will tell you what they love about the class the most is they actually become a part of the culture. So I bring the turntables in and the students are scratching on the turntables. I bring in the, a B-boy and they learn, you know, how to do footwork, how to do top rock, how to, you know, wow, and they learn popping and locking. So they actually are involved in the culture. And I think what that does is help push forward the idea that hip hop is a culture to be respected. And that's the part I love about it, man.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about graph as a form that often gets kind of forgotten, the four elements. Yep. And I was thinking about it when we lost DJ K Slay, who of course was who tagged as Dez back in the day.
Yep.
And that there's something about hip hop that I fell in love with first as a visual art form, not only through graph but through storytelling. You know, like one of my favorite early MCs was Slick Rick.
Yep, of course. Oh yeah.
Just because of how visual of a storyteller he was.
Yes.
And I guess, you know, selfishly, because you've been, you know, you've worked so closely in hip hop with so many folks, and I'm interested what you look for in an MC that does it for you, and if that's changed over the decades.
That's a good question. I think really what does it for me is the flow and delivery. I think those are for me top, and then comes the words, like what they say, like how they deliver it really just will take me like, oh, wow. Like like right now. And I can't remember their names. I'm still learning them, but, you hip to Coast Contra.
Oh yeah.
Oh absolutely. My goodness. Like these guys, like they are getting me excited again. Like that's the feel that's what I'll be looking for. When I'm listening to some new hip hop, I want somebody to make me feel like they make me feel like they take me there. You know what I'm saying? Like it just, you can tell they love what they do. The movements, the motions, the delivery, how they change their voices and do, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. Are there kind of, are there local MCs that you loved early on coming up? Because you came up in Columbus, right?
Yes, exactly. Born and raised, Columbus, Ohio, South Side. Definitely. I grew up, there's a group from Columbus that everybody needs to kind of do research. And if they really did, the guys are out there in plain sight. They're hiding in plain sight. But it's a group called Spirit. So Spirit consisted of, I'm sure you know, because you know hip hop. Spirit, Carnell, Malik Willoughby. The Willoughby brothers, Storm, all of these guys, they are kind of like what I modeled myself after. You know, my first talent show was with Spirit. Like they threw the talent show. I watched them and I emulated them with everything that I still do today. So they're a big influence. But these guys today are still influencing. Malik is like the king of yoga. He's got the yoga thing going. And Carnell, they got Willoughby Soul Veg down in North Market. So they're still reinventing and creating spaces for us, man. It's beautiful.
Now, not to get too, because I feel like I'm really on this stuff, and I followed your career for as long as you had a career. Thankfully, I was on the ground floor of it, and so I could talk to you about your production techniques for a long time.
Wow.
And so I'm gonna try to temper my excitement to do so. But I am interested in how you felt your production evolve, right? So like the first, I would imagine that the first very big song that folks would know that you touched is maybe Brown Skin Lady.
Yeah. Yes, I would agree, definitely. That was, I would say that one. Everybody on the avenue, I know when it's CSA. Fresher than Tony Rambo's vegetables at African street festivals where incredible women is plentiful. Over the years I met a few, none of them compared to you, preparing you to make fruit bearable, something terrible. Blessy, you fruitful, beautiful, smart, lovable, huggable.
And I love kind of the your production approach when it comes to the sample. Like, Are you very much into digging in the crates and finding things? Do you discover sounds that you're excited about and then think, I need to build this out? Or do you envision the beat first and then chase the sounds?
I love it. I mean, if you making me feel good. I appreciate this because now you're getting into my language. So I'm very much a part of what we call in hip hop digging, dig culture, digging in the crates. Yeah. I go to the record store somewhere, whether it's in Columbus or wherever I am, I go every week. I dig for records and new sounds and new music every week. It's part of my creative process. It helps me to grow. I learn music. I mean, I know jazz, I know rock, I know soul because of hip hop. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I grew up digging in the crates, so we've never changed that culture. This is something that, you know, me and my team, we do all the time. Like, if we hit a city, that's priority. That's the first thing what record stores do they have here? All right, we'll go to the record stores and then we'll go to the hotel and take a shower. Like, like that's our priority because that is, it's the source. It's the source for inspiration. So even if I don't exactly sample something, like I'll still get an idea and maybe replay or play something similar that I heard or something that gave me inspiration. So that is the epitome. That's the first part. That's the best part.
Yeah. Do you, I've talked to other producers who say they sometimes don't know what they're listening for even. Like right. What they're digging for. They're right. Just kind of digging until something,
yep.
You know, so what initially draws you to, like what jumps out?
Honestly, when I'm listening to music and I'm trying to figure out like what I want to do or if I'm digging in the crates, I start with I'll look at the label because I know certain labels are going to give me certain sounds. I look for the artists and the instruments that are played on the record. And then I'll also look at things like the year, you know, so you can, there's a lot of clues, a lot of things you can do without even being able to hear the record. But a lot of times, to be honest with you, we'll bring in like a little portable record player so we can kind of just check it out if we need to.
Oh, wow. Word.
Oh, yeah. Indeed. We serious with this, y'all.
Bring in a portable record player.
Heck yeah. Man. We do that constantly. That's how we do it.
I promise I'll not only talk about samples, but I'm obsessed with the art of sampling. And
yeah, me too. We can talk Willie, all day.
I feel like folks in hip hop have sampled Willie Hutch so much.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, there's just a great, you know, the framework for what Willie Hutch was doing. And there's that Lone Catalyst track, La 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 La, that samples. It samples Just Another Day, I think. And I remember hearing that and being like, this is a flip kind of. There's a way that you're kind of flipping some samples that feel unique. Minnie Riperton too on Check the Clock.
Wow.
There's stuff where it's like, I hear people sample Minnie a lot. Mm-hmm. I hear people sample Willie Hutch a lot, but you're kind of taking it maybe one step further and bending the sample in a way that feels unique. Do you ever hear other people's samples and ask yourself like, okay, how can I push this in a different way?
Sometimes, you know, like a Dilla or a High Tech or a Rashad, yeah. Q-Tip, those are pretty much like some of my biggest influence and Madlib. Right. And so I'll hear how they do something. But the thing about hip hop, this is what makes it so great. You could give all of those producers I just named and myself the same record and we'll all flip it differently. Right. We all hear it differently. And that's what makes hip hop so magical, because you can hear something one way. And then like maybe tomorrow I'll take it and I'll flip it again and I hear it a whole different way. And so, you know, when I hear other producers do stuff, I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool. But when I go in to make music, I never know how it's going to sound. I always start with drums. That's how I make my beats, no matter what. Always with drums. Even if I end up changing the drums or doing a different pattern, I always start with drums, because for me in hip hop, drums are the foundation.
Yeah. Speaking of High Tech, is he? I know he's still out here. I know he's still busy. Mm-hmm. I know he's still working.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a world wherein in the future you see the two of you collaborating on something?
It's so crazy. Are you really? You really just asked that? That's crazy. So me and High Tech over the last couple of months have been building a lot, and we have actually. I'm helping him. I'm curating his songs. He's going to release an instrumental series of all his beats. He's going to do 50 beats, 10 beats from 1993 to 1997. And so I've been helping him curate some of that goodness, because what happened was, you know, he and I were real close back in the day. So I had a lot of his music. So he came to me like, yo, you remember some of them old beats? What one should I put out? So we just been building like that. So, yes, in answer to your question, High Tech and I are going to collaborate. Indeed.
I can't wait. You know, High Tech is Ohio legend, to say the least.
To say the least, right?
To touch on DJing for a minute, earlier in the early portion of the pandemic, you were one of the folks who was doing like really good work in terms of just like doing lives and whatnot, actually DJing, right?
Yeah.
And a thing I've been thinking about lately, and I part of me doesn't want to disparage folks, but if it goes there, it goes there. There's something I've been worrying about, and it's the devaluation of the DJ. Because there are folks who perhaps have DJ in their name but are so far removed, maybe have never touched a record, or are so far removed from the touching of a record that, you know, the DJ moniker perhaps does not hold the same weight it does.
Yes.
And I get worried about that, because DJing, there's a core tenet of hip-hop where I think if you remove the history of the DJ, I think you just remove a lot of the narrative of how hip-hop became hip-hop. I mean, as you know, the DJ at one point was the show.
Yes,
you know, the MC was like the side person. DJ was the show.
Correct.
And so how do you see this as well? Are you concerned about this as well? And how do you build upon the legacy of DJing, not just in the classroom, but, you know, out in the world, so that it does not fall victim to these kind of correctives that get issued when it comes to hip-hop history?
Great question. You know, I teach that in my class. The DJ is the genesis of hip hop. You know, without the DJ, hip hop doesn't exist. In fact, when you're speaking of the elements, the MC came last. Right. That was a forethought. And then, yes, it took over, but it wasn't the thing. It's like you said, the DJ was the show. So it is important to keep that in mind. I think there are several things that are being done, and the mainstream world may not quite know yet, but there's a lot of vinyl purists. If you watch Twitch is kind of where we live right now. So all the DJs, from Jazzy Jeff to Scratch Bastard to all of the Beat Junkies to Q-Bert to, I mean, everybody almost, all of the DJs go live on Twitch. And many of them DJ vinyl. In fact, most of them will have an all vinyl set. You know, sometimes, of course, they use the computer, they use Serato, but many of them keep that important element of the culture still at hand. So it's still there. And then when you look at DJs like Amira and Kayla, and then you look at like DJ Michelle, like these young DJs coming up, they are using Serato and using Serato Scratch Records. So they're DJing on turntables and not on CDJs. So I think there are people that are trying to keep the movement out there. I worry a little bit, but that's why, you know, there's people like us who push the culture and constantly make sure that we let people know this is what it is. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. To kind of take us back a bit, I didn't want to start out going through the history of your career, but how did you kind of, you know, there was an era, I think, for me, I was lucky enough to have multiple older siblings, and I feel like having older siblings in the 90s was really special, because there was this real rebirth of college radio. And so to have like an older brother and an older sister in college and have them just bring back music was really unique. And I had, you know, there's a point, I think, where you like kick rhymes in a basement or you, that kind of thing, but it's never serious. Like in my house, it was never serious. Like I never thought I'm going to be a rapper. It was just like, you know, we watch you on TV Raps, or we watch The Basement and you know, Rhapsody, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Where for you did that impulse become serious, or was it always serious? Like as a child, were you like, this is my, like when I was a kid, my interest in music was far higher than average, but I also knew that my talent to create music was far lower than average.
Got it.
And so I had to find a different way in, you know what I mean?
Right.
For you, was it one of these things where it was like your interest and talent always intersected at a high point?
Not even close. I'm from Columbus, Ohio, right? So there weren't many opportunities to become like, you know, a big hip hop star. That's not how it was. We always created music. I can remember 84, 85, like getting Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde genius rap, and like just constantly like rapping over that instrumental. And so that's how we kind of formulated learning and trying to emulate what we were hearing. And so fast forward to about 1988, I got a Casio SK5, which was a sampling machine. It had about 4 seconds of sampling time, had some fake drums on it. I mean, it was like the entry into trying to make beats. But that's all we had here. I think I got it at like Kmart or Gold Circle. It's like, you know, one of those kind of things that and I actually just posted my SK5, but it on Instagram. But it's that was my foundation. And then I started learning about and watching other people use the SP1200 or the MPC 3000, the ASR10. And so I started just kind of jumping into that foray. And when I was making music in 88, 89, 90, all that, before I went to University of Cincinnati, it was for fun. We were enjoying it. And it was just a part of what we did. We did try to get a deal or do whatever. But coming from Columbus, like I said, very difficult. So I never thought, you know, I'd get into the industry. I never did. But I went to the University of Cincinnati and ended up doing music and producing for many of the acts that were bubbling in the city. So you're talking about Fat John and the 5Ds. Yeah. You're talking about Home Skillet. You're talking about Dose One. You're talking about Mood. And so I ended up working with a lot of these people, and I was introduced to Quali through Mood, through these guys. And you know, and the rest is history. You know, Quali introduced me to Mos Def, and now here we are, you know, that kind of thing. But it was never like something I said, yo, I'm going to do this. I can make this happen. It was very organic, to be honest with you, Hanif. It was very organic, and I was blessed. That's all I can say.
Incredible. You know, yesterday I talked to Richard Duarte Brown, and some of our talk turned towards mentorship and passing down this kind of legacy and lineage of what one knows to a next generation. Now, obviously, you are teaching in that way, but are you kind of hands-on with any young producers in the city or any, you know, I came up in an era where, you know, I feel like my most prominent era of being really close to Columbus hip-hop was, say, the, like, Fly Union era. And it felt for me, it always felt for me like the city just had a lot of talent.
Yep.
And perhaps did not have the consistency or ability for access or these kind of things. Mm-hmm. Are there younger producers that you've worked with or younger artists that you've worked with or younger DJs that you've worked with to, mm-hmm. that you think could help build some of that consistency? Or is it kind of just, do you feel like your work is in the classroom and that's it?
Oh, no. My work far grows the classroom. The classroom is one aspect, but I'm still in the community. I'm still in the music business. I still, you know, constantly work on music. I have new music coming out all the time. You know, it's funny you mention Columbus and people that I mentor. And you said Fly Union. So Jay Swiffer is one of the producers of Fly Union, and he's so talented. And so he and I were talking actually last week, and he came out to there was a record show, Colleen's Collectibles. She does a record show. And so I told him, I said, man, if you want to come talk to me, come to the record show. And he came to the record show. So he was digging with us as we were in the crates, and he was just learning and getting information. And I never thought of it like that until he said, man, you know, you're one of my mentors. And I was like, I am? Really? And I never really thought of it like that. But I guess there have been a lot of producers in Columbus that may say that, you know, Rashad and different people, and even people, MCs like King Veda and things like that. Like, and I never, it's not, I guess what I'm saying is I don't sit there and look at somebody and say, hey, I'm going to mentor you. You know what I mean? It's just through interaction, we work together and I give advice. And if they choose to take it, cool. If they don't, that's okay too. There's another young producer that I met while I was teaching at Tiffin University, and he lives in Columbus now, and he's doing work on the scene, and he's kind of making a name for himself. His name is Eric Brown, and he's doing things. So it's like there's a lot of talent here in the city. I think it's like what you said, though, the ability of access. And it's the same thing when I was growing up. It's very difficult to make it from here. yes. you know, with the bunny ears, make it, quote unquote, make it.
Quote unquote, make it. Right, right, right. You are prolific, and I kind of want to touch on the nature of that. I mean, you know, Jazz Hop is the latest project, right? I mean, that's the, which I missed that, you know, that's one of those things where I missed out on the, on the, on the vinyl, the limited edition vinyl joints. It was wild. Those went, and I was not hip to them, and I got the Bandcamp streaming joint, but the vinyl passed me up.
It went in like, it was like 2 weeks. So I couldn't have told you like, yo, you better get, I didn't know.
But you've also kind of, I mean, in the past, you've done these this run of kind of instrumental records over the past handful of years, which isn't new. I mean, they've kind of just really come out at a rapid pace. How do you make, just from a pure work process standpoint, how are you making the time, and are you finding time for yourself?
That's a good question. I try to find time for myself. Not sure that I do. I'm working on it, though. The wife, really, she's helping me with that. I think, really, for me, I just like to create. There will be times when I get inspired. And so I was only using the Insonic ASR-10. So that is not portable. It's not mobile. It's not a computer. I had to be in my studio or I couldn't make beats. And so Retmatic introduced me to Serato. They have a program called Serato Studio. And I don't know why, but it just clicked. It just flows. The workflow in it is very reminiscent of the ASR-10. So I was able to do. So now I can create everywhere. I'm actually in my office at Ohio State. I'll sit there and just work on some music, you know, before the next class. And so I think I work whenever I can be creative. And now that I have that freedom, like, for instance, you know, I'm going to be on a plane here in a couple of days. I'll be working on the plane. And that's going to open me up even more. So now I'll just be able to create and create. So when I'm in a creative mood, I'll either write, you know, publish, because I got to publish articles, right? Because I'm a professor, right? Or I'll create music. Like, so it just depends on which creative force is in me at the time, or which one has me most inspired. Sometimes I'll read an article, like Chris Emden or Emery Petchauer drops a new article about hip hop based education. I'm like, oh, they got me pumped. So now I'm sitting here and I'm going to type for the next few days. I'm working on an article. Or, you know, I'm sitting here and high tech send me like, yo, check out this new beat. And I'm like, oh, I got to get in the lab. So it's like that. That's how I get inspired.
Incredible. Do you ever, you know, I know that some of your work too is the work of revisitation. So like the 1998 album where you kind of unearthed that stuff from the Dat Tape and then, you know, like worked it out, massaged it out. Do you ever feel like you are at a point where you will stop being so hands-on with music? Or do you think that this is just, you're always going to kind of be creating in the modes that you create with the frequency that you're creating, which feels like it is picking up too, as it, years go.
If somebody else said that, it might be picking up because I'm enjoying it more. There was a time there, maybe about 10 years ago, where I just wasn't having as much fun, and now I'm having fun. So to answer your question, I honestly never plan on stopping making music. I plan on being 88, 90. If I make it that far, I'm going to still be creating music. Doesn't necessarily mean it'll come out, but I'll still be creating it. And I, you know, that's just fun for me, that I enjoy that. So yeah, I plan on still working always.
Well, I look forward to it, brother. J. Rawls. Dr. J. Rawls, thank you for joining me.
My brother, I appreciate you, man. Have a good one.
You too.
All right, peace.
Started as a normal day.
What if the truth about the greatest tragedy of your life
was kept secret from you.
Huge explosion occurred.
This is the story of a scandal deliberately buried in the chaos of the Iraq War.
What really just happened?
Listen to NPR's Embedded podcast and its latest series, Taking Cover.
At the end of every episode, I take some time to share one of my small joys, and today it's a little brief. I mean, you won't hear this on the day that I'm recording it, but today is it is Eid. It is the end of Ramadan. For me, as someone who fasted and participated in Ramadan this year, Eid is always really renewing. It's a really renewing time for me to kind of sit with the intentions that I had going into the month and ask myself questions around how well I fulfilled those intentions, and did I create a container for those intentions that can be carried with me through the rest of the year? And so on a more tactile level, though, Eid is something I always enjoy, because when I was young, we would have Eid breakfast. We would go to the mosque and we would eat. It's amazing to think about now, but we would just eat donuts and pastries and eggs and these kind of things after after a long time of not being able to eat with the sun out. It was really refreshing and freeing. And so every year now I kind of continue in that tradition, and I pick up pastries and donuts for the kids at the mosque, and I got to do that this morning. I don't really eat them myself these days. I need a little bit more of a run-up before I get into donuts at 7 in the morning. But it was good to go to Resh's Bakery, my East Side Bakery, the bakery I grew up knowing and loving, and pick up some donuts for the young folks and take them over to the mosque and enjoy an Eid meal and enjoy the kind of just absolute pleasure that I think young folks have. It's renewing for me. It kind of brings out the child that still is present in myself, and to get to bear witness to it, I think is a joy that will carry me for months and months and months after this one. Small Joys is a production of WOSU Public Media and part of the NPR network. The show is produced and edited by Michael DeBonis, sound engineering by Eric French. Nick Hauser is the Chief Content Director of Digital Media. Thanks to Leticia Wiggins for editorial support, and thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate the show on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. We'll be back next week with more Small Joys.